صلي على طه النبي وآله.
If Allah has said to eat halal and He has forbidden the haram things or the other things which are forbidden, therefore we need to get rid of it. For example, alcohol is haram. It is haram by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah does not like this. This is something which has been imposed by the colonizers in the human society. So the societies should be free of the things that are forbidden by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because in the Quran, Allah says, Ya ayyuhan nas, kulu min tayyibat. All the mankind, eat from the pure things. Now, here Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran is talking about the mankind, not the Muslims. He says, Ya ayyuhan nas, all the mankind, there are pure things for you in this world, which has been made allowed to you to eat it from and avoid the impure things, avoid the things which are not pure, avoid the forbidden things. Therefore, there are many things that are pure and we need to have those things. Therefore, if the mankind can follow the Islamic teachings, if the Muslims with their deeds, with their actions, can truly follow the Islam, then obviously it signals that the end of the colonizers is reaching very near, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the limelight.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski aims to maintain a Senate seat in November's midterm elections as she faces off against an opponent endorsed by former President Donald Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Jason Lemon. The article has been published by Newsweek. The piece is titled Lisa Murkowski's Chances of Beating Trump-backed Rival According to polls. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski aims to maintain a Senate seat in November's midterm elections as she faces off against an opponent endorsed by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Senator Murkowski, widely viewed as a centrist Republican, drew Donald Trump's ire after she voted for his conviction, along with six other GOP senators, in a Senate impeachment trial after he was charged with inciting his supporters to attack the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. In June of last year, the former president officially backed Kelly Shibaka in her bid to unseat the Alaska senator. Last November, the Alaskan senator confirmed she'd seek another six-year term. Despite Donald Trump's endorsement of Kelly Shibaka, recent opinion polls suggest that Lisa Murkowski is still well-positioned to hold on to her seat. However, Alaska is also implementing a new nonpartisan ranked choice primary system, as well as ranked choice general election ballots this year, making final results less easy to predict with some accuracy. Analysts have speculated that the new system could benefit Lisa Murkowski. Polling conducted from 16th to 21st of April by Alaska Survey Research showed that Lisa Murkowski leading Kelly Shibaka by double digits, 10 percentage points among likely voters in Alaska. The survey showed the incumbent with the support of 55% of likely voters, compared with just 45% who backed Kelly Schabaka. The survey questioned 1,208 respondents and had a margin of error of plus or minus 2.9 percentage points. A previous opinion poll carried out from 14th to 16th of March boded better for Kelly Schabaka. The Trump-backed challenger was narrowly ahead of Lisa Murkowski by 2 percentage points in that survey by Signal, which was commissioned by Schabaka's campaign. The GOP senator, Lisa Murkowski, received about 49% of the vote, as opposed to her rival's approximately 51%. 500 Alaskans were surveyed. While the most recent Alaska survey research poll showed that Lisa Murkowski was well-positioned compared with Kelly Schabaka, the survey also demonstrated a notable decline from a previous one conducted last October. That autumn poll of 969 registered voters put the incumbent 20 points ahead of her opponent. Lisa Murkowski had the backing of 60% of the voters, compared with just 40% for Kelly Schabaka. Under Alaska's new ranked choice system, whether Murkowski or Schabaka is the most popular candidate among Republicans will have less of an impact. The nonpartisan primary system the state is implementing allows the top four candidates, regardless of party affiliation, to advance to the general election. Website 538 assesses that Alaska has a 14.6 percentage point partisan lean in favor of Republicans, however, meaning that conservative voters are expected to be the dominant force in November's general election. At the same time, Lisa Murkowski does not have to worry about being defeated in a GOP primary. She just has to make it into the top four in the nonpartisan primary on 16th of August in order to appear on November's ballot. The new system also allows for voters' second, third, and fourth choices of candidates to potentially receive their backing if no contender wins more than 50% in the first round of counting. The Alaska Division of Elections website explains, the last-place candidate from each race in round one is eliminated and their supporter's second-choice selection is allocated to the remaining candidates on the ballot. This vote redistribution process continues until one candidate reaches over 50% of the votes, or until two candidates remain and the candidate with the most votes wins. In each round of counting, each voter gets one vote. Analysts have said this system could benefit Lisa Murkowski, as she may receive the backing of independents and moderate Democrats. While these voters may not list her as their first choice, they may mark the GOP senator as their second or even third choice. Depending on how much support each candidate receives in the first round, she could come out on top in a second or third round of counting. Notably, Senator Murkowski has previously demonstrated her ability to buck the odds and win in her state of Alaska. In 2010, she won re-election as a write-in candidate after she lost in the state's GOP primary. At the time, she was the first senator in more than five decades to win as a write-in candidate.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the US economy destroyed US production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Doctor, actually, on this point, if I may, with your permission, it's very interesting because you mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski. He actually states very clearly in his book, this was written in the late 20th century, he says that the worst scenario for America, he clearly states this, the worst scenario for America is an alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. So this is not some like when you are mentioning these things, when we in Iran talk about these things, these are not some sort of, you know, guesses. These are not some sort of conspiracy theories. These are things that are stated very clearly and openly by the leadership and by the elites in America. And so this is in terms of just, you know, complementing what you're saying, that, you know, it's clearly stated just as. It's very interesting for me because the things you mentioned, my specialty is strategic studies, international relations. Many of the things that you're mentioning are said, we talk about these things in strategic studies, in international relations, of course, in our own language, in our own jargon that we have. So, for example, you mentioned the British and their whole desire since the 19th century to destroy the Russian Empire. Well, again, this is clearly stated by Halford Mackinder, who is considered the father, or so-called the founding father of modern geopolitics and geostrategic studies. Of course, he was a geographer who for the first time looked at the world as one geostrategic unit and talked about the fact that whoever wants to rule the world has to control, of course, he used his own language, but what we would call today Eurasia, that if Eurasia on its own is so big and powerful and capable of, and if we look at historically, and you know, I think there were economists in Holland that did a long-term study about this, which is that if you look at the global history, 80 to 90% of global history has been dominated in terms of the economic production and the center of civilization being in Eurasia, being in Asia. So this idea that somehow the North Atlantic or the Americans would dominate the world is actually a very strange and unusual situation that we had in human history. It's coming back to this situation where it was for centuries and for millennia. But you see people like Halford Mackinder clearly stating that their goal is to prevent any Eurasian power coming and becoming powerful and being a rival. And at that time, this is all in emphasizing the points you were making from a strategic studies perspective, that very clearly Halford Mackinder stating that the goal has to be that in no way, shape, or form should Russia and Germany be allied and be united, and that there has to always be a buffer zone between Germany and Russia where they can exploit these petty nationalisms, where these countries can either be used against Germany or can be used against Russia. Anytime there's a danger that you would see Russia or Germany becoming powerful and then uniting in terms of strategically and economically, as you were mentioning, as was already happening in the 19th century. The other thing that was very interesting for me, Doctor, was that actually there's serious people who would argue that the Americans, in a way, actually also had a Ministry of Industry that was controlling its industrial growth after World War II. It was just called the Pentagon. It wasn't called the Ministry of Industry. It was called the Ministry of Defense. So in a way, yes, they had those corporations that were, on paper, they were private. And they were, of course, private. The profits went to the oligarchs. It created an oligarchy in the United States. But its strategic coordination was done at the Pentagon. So things like the internet, things like mobile technology, mobile phones, all those technologies that we saw, you know, emerging out of the 20th century, if you trace a lot of them back, you see even things like civilian aircraft, civilian passenger flight. A lot of these things that were technologies that transformed the world technologically, if you trace back the money, you see that at some point they went back to the Pentagon and programs that were financed. And the reason is this, Doctor, and I'm so happy we're able to talk about these things on television, which is that very rarely do you have private investors willing to invest large sums of money for something that will be profitable in 10 or 20 years. This is just not something that a private investor will do. The horizon for profitability is maximum 4 to 5 years. And this is why, in reference to the new model that you are referring to in terms of the model that is being used in China or India, but also to a certain extent in Iran, which I will talk about a little bit with your permission. So what we need is, and this is exactly actually what happened in the US as well, which is that private companies were not willing to invest into technologies such as civilian airliners, such as those other advanced technologies, because it would have taken them 10, 15 years to get the profits. So the government comes in, gives them something called a government contract. This allows them to have profits and then take those profits for themselves or invest it into other areas. I think in Iran, we had a very similar experience as you were describing with China and India. Of course, I think, this is my personal view, is that the places where we made a mistake is where we sort of blindly imitated some of those bad habits that we see in the West in terms of financialing, making the economy more financial-based, not having those controls that they have in India and in China. So all this, what I want to sum up with is that a lot of the things that you are mentioning, which is very interesting, is exactly also things that in strategic studies and international relations we also talk about, of course, in our own language. And what we say in international relations or in strategic studies is that when those realities on the ground, those technologies, those real indicators of power and wealth, when they shift and the political institutions do not shift, that's when the conflict happens. So you have a reality in the world where the Americans bankrupted themselves pretty much by 2008, if you look at the financial crisis that happened in the United States. You had the so-called war on terror. I would just suggest this to you, Doctor, that actually the hybrid war, as far as the Iranians are concerned, has been going on since the 1990s. We've been experiencing all those elements that you describe as a hybrid war in Iran since the 1990s. Of course, because the scale of the conflict was smaller, maybe a lot of people in the world didn't realize this. Of course, those who were experts understood what the Americans were doing in Iran and in trying to fight Iran. All those elements that are now being used in this hybrid war against Russia and China were first used, tested, tried with Iran. And I think the interesting thing for maybe Russia and China is to look and to see how was Iran capable of resisting and not succumbing to this hybrid war. A lot of it, which of course you also indicated, which is to have that strategic management being centralized, but also taking advantage of market mechanisms and allowing both the forces that are social, but also the forces that are related to the central government being able to coordinate the different interests that exist. So with that in mind, I apologize. I just felt that there was it was very interesting to me. I wanted to add and emphasize some of the points you were saying from our perspective as strategic studies or international relations. So with that in mind, Dr. Gazaev, what does the future look like? What is it, how is it that we're going to now move away from this system dominated by what is becoming an inefficient American system, a system that is abusing that system of banking and money, which was serving it for a purpose for a period of time, and weaponizing it and using it as a political tool and weapon against different countries. One thing that maybe we could talk about is the idea that, for example, why is it that we denominate all major important commodities in the dollar? I mean, Iran has a lot of oil and gas. Russia has a lot of oil and gas. Why do we have to sell it in dollars to India and China? We are neighbors. We're on the same continent. How is it that things like dollar hegemony and those other things that are the markers of the current system, what is the future going to look like? How can we replace these things that are currently existing with new systems, and what are those new systems going to be? And if you could please, we don't have a lot more time left, just if you could give us the gist of it.
I'll try to be brief. According to the long-term economic growth theory, it is quite clear that America is going to lose. It is no doubt that America will lose its leadership as well. The British Empire lost it a century ago. Not because we don't like America. It's because America has obsolete and, in fact, inefficient economic system. They use their financial opportunities. They still have hegemony in the world of finance. Still, American dollar dominates in all transactions, which you mentioned, in the currency reserves. But it is very important that America lost its privilege to print the world money about 1 month ago. Of course, you're right that Iran is suffering from this hybrid war about 30 years. And of course, we had to look for the Iranian experience. Unfortunately, the Russian financial elite was very confident in the American state, in American policy, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian economy becomes, in fact, the peripheral economy. It was used by the Americans as a donor, and by the Europeans. Yes. We exported raw materials, and we had capital flight about $100 billion per year. And the Russian economy was too much dependent from the American influence, especially the governance of the Russian central banks was controlled by the IMF, and IMF recommendations were implemented in Russia with catastrophic results. But America was too much, it was too much concentrated on Russophobia, mm-hmm. and it played a bad joke with the Americans. They used their main weapon, the dominance in the world financial system, against Russia, and they did not have any cards more. The American dollar is not considered as a reserve currency anymore in Asia. Of course, you have such experience before. For you, dollar is not reserve currency for a long time. But for Russia, and now for China as well, America, and for India, I am sure, American dollar lost its image as a world currency, and America so lost its main weapon, I should say. In this book, which I showed to you, I made some recommendations. They were written about, as I mentioned, 6 years ago. And the first recommendations was to, if you want to finish this war, if you want to save the mankind from the American aggression, we have to create coalition between those countries who are not interested in the war, who want peaceful development, and who are constructing now the new world economic mode. So we have to avoid to get rid from dollar. Get rid from dollar as a world currency in trade, in reserves, in financial transactions. For Russia and for Iran, it is no question anymore. It is no question also, I think, for China. And American superpower is undermined now because the world do not believe in American dollar anymore. And we have to move as far as possible for the national currencies in our relations. And now in our economic commission, we are trying to elaborate with the Russian academician experts, trying to elaborate the model for the new world currency. Mm-hmm. It should be based on the commodity basket. As you mentioned, Russia and Iran have dominance in the oil sector.
Exactly.
We also have dominance together in the metallurgy, in the chemical sector, in water, in coal, in a lot of commodities. We can organize the common economic space, which will be independent from the Western benchmarks. What we are thinking about to create the Asian exchange. Mm-hmm. Which will generate its own prices. Prices should for all those commodities should not be generated in London or in New York. These are our commodities, and we can organize our economic space in such a way that the price formation for those commodities will satisfy our needs, not needs of the Western speculations, but the needs of the production sector.
Doctor, if I excuse me, so if I understand you correctly, we are looking maybe at a special international currency, not a national currency, but one that is backed by the national currencies and the commodities, and that so
yes.
is this correct? Did I understand this correctly? That
yes.
This would
the
then
idea,
be.
Go
ahead, please.
The idea is to create the new world currency, which could be used for the trans-border transactions. This currency should be constructed on the basis of the basket of the national currencies, mm-hmm. of those countries which are involved in this process, like a special development, special deposit rights of the IMF.
Yes.
But on the basis of the another principles, more fair and more clear. And another part of this currency should be the basket of commodities. If you combine together the basket of national currencies and basket of commodities and create the synthetic currency based on this about 30 subjects in the basket, we can create a strong currency, which will be very stable in spite of all the international conjuncture.
So, excuse me, Doctor, so let me understand you correctly. So this currency is not a currency that we in different countries would be having in our wallets in our bank accounts. We would still be using our national accounts. This would be a purely international currency used by for the transaction between countries for the sale of the commodities that exist, that it would be backed by the power of the national currencies and by the commodities that are so abundant in Asia. Which is interesting, because you talked about fiat money. It's actually very, very new that we have fiat money. For throughout human history, we actually had commodity-backed money. We had money that there was something that people could back it with. So this is going back to that, in a certain way, going back to that.
Yes, but you are quite right. In international transactions, if you are speaking about the national economies, each country has its own national currency.
Very good.
Fiat currency, which can be used for monetary support of the investment activity. But the currency which I'm talking about is the currency for international transactions. Of course, we need some kind of organization like that. For instance, in BRICS, we have the basket of the reserve currencies of BRICS. We can involve BRICS countries as well, not only Asian countries, but let's take also Brazil and South Africa, use the BRICS organization. So the idea is to get rid from any kind of private monopoly on the world money. The new world money should be created on the basis of international treaty. This is the first foundation of the new economic world economic structure. The second foundation is the information technologies. As you know, the American Agency of National Security is the cyber terrorist number one in the world. Mm-hmm. Almost about half of cyber attacks are coming from the United States, from the one place, Agency of National Security. The United States is the only country which don't want to sign the International Treaty for Cybersecurity. So our peace coalition should also has another, not only monetary treaty, but also a treaty on information technology. The Convention Against Cyber Terrorism. And those countries, like the United States, who doesn't want to sign this agreement and to fulfill this agreement, should be under our sanctions. So we shouldn't use information technologies which are developed by the countries who sponsor the cyber terrorism, like the United States and Great Britain. This is the second foundation. And the third foundation, which becomes also very actual. As you know, the Americans is the only country in the world which openly violated the International Convention Against the Biological Weapons. As we have seen in Ukraine, the Americans were conducting the elaboration of the biological weapons using the Ukrainian population. So the COVID pandemic is also part of this biological war. So our coalition of the countries which want to finish this hybrid war and to create opportunities for the peaceful, sustainable economic growth, to my mind, should have three basic foundations. The first one is the Treaty Convention on the Issuing of the World Money, which I described. The second one, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism, which will regulate the use of information technologies in the world. And the third one, the Convention on the Control over the Fulfillment of the Convention on Biological Security. So these are three foundations will be enough to create a very powerful worldwide coalition against American aggression. And I think here in Asia, we can be able to create new architecture, financial architecture, trade architecture of economic relations, which will be based on the mutual interests, which will be based on the international law, and which will be quite different from the liberal globalization led by Washington, because each country has its sovereign rights to elaborate those type of regulation of economy which is adequate to its cultural heritage, to the people's norms of behavior, and the diversity of the economic national systems is also the part of this new world economic mode. The main idea of international relations should be creation opportunities for the growth of investments, not trade liberalization, not currency liberalization, but creation of more opportunities for economic growth, for the growth of the well-being of societies, for the growth of the real incomes of the population. So I think together we can organize such kind of new economic mode, which will be attractive for the whole world.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much. We've run out of time, unfortunately. It was very interesting talking to you. And on that positive note, thank you so much. And hopefully, if there's opportunity arises, we can continue this discussion at a later time. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Glazev? If we look at the issue from the perspective of long-term economic cycles analysis, the era of U.S. economic power is coming to an end, and a new era of economic power based in Asia, particularly in China and India, is beginning because of more efficient production models that have been established there in recent years, combining centralized strategic planning with market forces and the channeling of profits into production as opposed to channeling them into the personal wealth of a few wealthy oligarchs. In contrast, the U.S. has shifted from a production-based economy to a financially dominated economy, characterized by extreme wealth gaps and the channeling of profits into the hands of a few oligarchs and into offshore tax havens, instead of into the expansion of production and jobs, an issue central to the Trump and America First campaign and presidency, and one of the keys to understanding the current social and political conflict that exists domestically in the U.S. We can add to this America's endless global war against terror that has been going on for more than 20 years and which has morally and infrastructurally bankrupted the U.S. with trillions of dollars spent on foreign wars, while basic needs and infrastructure are at a third world level in many parts of the United States. We can further add to this the fact that the Western-dominated global financial and banking systems are losing credibility because of their weaponization by the U.S. to wage economic war against its global rivals and enemies, thus accelerating the emergence of a new non-Western global financial and banking system that allows countries to engage in trade and commerce outside of U.S. dollar hegemony. The geostrategic alignment of China, Russia, and Iran, which the late American geostrategist Zbigniew Brzezinski called America's worst-case scenario, has also entered into the express lane, particularly after the severe sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its European vassals on Russia following the Ukrainian war, which have effectively cut Russia off from the West and have accelerated Russia's strategic reorientation towards Asia and the global South. All this sets the stage for a fundamental change in the global order and very interesting and eventful times in the years and decades to come. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, behavior with the neighbors. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of behaviouring with the neighbours in the Islamic lifestyle. When we say that in the Islamic teachings, there is a lot of emphasis on having a good relation with the neighbors and giving the rights of neighbors and taking care of the neighbors, then obviously there are some behaviors that we should have in relation to our neighbors. And amongst those relations in the teachings is to have a good behavior with them. And we need to do ihsan the way we do ihsan or goodness to our parents. We need to have this good behavior with our neighbors at all time. On the other hand, when we are living at a place, we need to make sure that our neighbors are not disturbed because of us. For example, if our kids are there, if we are having guests, or maybe if we are leaving the house or coming back to the house, it should be in a way so that our neighbors are not getting disturbed. For example, you know, in the West, I know that people are living in the sharing houses as well. Maybe there are the students, so I'm just going to give you an example of the students. For example, students, they rent a room in a house where there are other people that are also living. So we should enter into house in a way so that if our neighbors, maybe they are sleeping, maybe they are having guests, maybe they are doing something and they do not want others to disturb them. So we need to enter the house and exit in a way so that they are not getting disturbed because of us. Maybe not closing the door or shutting the door hardly or strongly so that it makes a noise. So we need to make sure that we are taking care of them and we are not disturbing them in any way or any kind in which it will be an insult towards them. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of behavior with the neighbors in the Islamic lifestyle, and we said we should behave in a way so that they are not disturbed because of us and they feel peaceful when we are there. On the other hand, there are other things to do. For example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, when he raised his hands, he used to pray for the neighbors. And the best thing about the neighbors is the best pray for the neighbors is that we need to have first the Muslim neighbors, the one who are same in the religion with us. And on top of that, when he used to pray that Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And then he used to say, وَتَوَلَّنِي فِي جِيرَانِي وَمَوَالِي الْعَارِفِينَ بِحَقِّنَا. O Allah, make our neighbors the one who has our love, the love of Ahlul Bayt, عَلَيْهِمُ السَّلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ. وَالْمُنَابِذِينَ لِأَعْدَائِنَا بِأَفْضَلِ وِلَايَتِكَ. And they are the enemies of our enemies. So the love of Ahlul Bayt and having a love or showing the love towards Ahlul Bayt, it is one of the prayers that we can pray for our neighbors, that they also are from the lovers of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wasalam. And they are also from those who hate the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. Why? Because Ahlul Bayt are the role model. They are here for reaching us in order to take us towards the perfection. So if we have the love of those who takes us towards the perfection and we are having or we want to have this journey of perfection, if we have such neighbors next to us, it will be easy for us to have the same journey and they can also accompany us in the same journey. So therefore, this is very important. And the main point is to pray for your neighbors, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rock hopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You will have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? What's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways. And that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point. And that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I want to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Kololangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. It replaces the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. While some drivers are obsessed with the speed, some others have a passion for the look of their cars. In Tehran, car tuning lovers have assembled for the biggest show of modified vehicles. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
Fast and furious. It's the biggest show of personal cars turned SUVs. Held in Tehran's Island Karting Track, the event brought together more than 500 motorists to flaunt their modified cars.
This is the only place where car tuning lovers can vent their energy and show off their beautiful cars. When I saw the call for such a big assembly of modified vehicles, I didn't waste a moment and decided to bring my car here.
Exhausts sound deeper, with flames popping out. Sound systems rattled the car roofs. And regular doors are replaced by butterfly doors, opening upward. To these people, car tuning is more than a hobby, but a passion. Majid says he has spent double the price of this Peugeot 206 to turn it into a green beast.
For us, our cars mean everything. To me, it's love. I save whatever I earn to spend on my car. So I urge the police to respect this love and stop fining us when we roll with our cars on the streets.
Based on Iran's traffic regulations, drivers are not allowed to alter the original design of their cars. Installing loudspeakers and noisy exhaust systems, and even attaching stickers, are associated with fines. Omid says he can't take this. He has transformed his Iranian-made car, dubbed Rana, into a whole new model, saying it looks better now on the street.
I spent whatever I could afford to make the streets look better with our cars, but the police are treating us like we are wrongdoers. I myself oppose dangerous driving in the city. What I want is just to make my car look more attractive.
Car tuning encompasses any modification to a vehicle that would lead to a higher engine performance and dynamic handling of the car. As long as these people stick to these rules, police will not have issues. Otherwise, they must keep these beauties inside their parking lots.
Thank you. However eye-catching they are, these mutated cars are no longer road pets and are good for drifting on tracks like this. Organizers say that's exactly why they held this show. To provide a chance for car tuning maniacs to vent their energy in a safe place. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.